25 years ago today, the people of Hong Kong saw the end of more than 150 years of British occupation and the beginning of Chinese rule under the Communist Party. And to say the least, life in Hong Kong is not the same.
For Hong Kongers, as they're known, Beijing promised a one-country, two-systems concept. They could keep their way of life, their social and capitalist systems, for 50 years. But at this halfway point, 25 years in, Hong Kong's freedoms are eroding. The government in Beijing pushed a bill to extradite suspects in Hong Kong to mainland China for trial. That led to massive protests in 2019 and then brutal crackdowns. Then in 2020, new national security measures made it easier to prosecute and jail dissidents and protesters, further silencing Hong Kongers.
Journalist and author Louisa Lim has been living and reporting on this story. She grew up in Hong Kong, and her latest book is Indelible City, Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong. Louisa, how are you, my friend?
I'm very well. How are you, Scott?
I'm great. Full disclosure, you're an old friend and journalist colleague. My goodness, we met in Shanghai together 16 years ago. I want to ask about, of course, the people of Hong Kong, their story, and the handover. But first of all, the Hong Kong identity, Hong Kong values. You grew up there. How do you define what the Hong Kong identity is?
Well, it's a complicated identity that is really an identity in flux, in motion. It's really changed over time. I mean, I guess one of the things about Hong Kong identity is it's not necessarily ethnic. You don't need to be Chinese in order to be a Hong Konger. Mm-hmm. And you don't really even need to be born in Hong Kong to be a Hong Konger. Mm. So it's much more about an identification with a kind of certain set of values. And mm-hmm. they're really liberal, democratic values, respect for the rule of law, for democracy, for meritocracy. These kind of things are Hong Kong values. And in 2019, when the protests, these massive protests broke out in Hong Kong, it was really because Hong Kongers felt that those values were under threat. You know, the mm-hmm, independent mm-hmm. judiciary that they valued so much was being threatened by the idea of this extradition legislation that the government wanted to introduce. And so people came out on the streets to protect it. In 2014, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. for the Umbrella Movement, it was also for more democracy. So it's a very strong kind of civic rights-based identity.
And let's talk about how the handover fits in to this. 25 years ago today, you were a young journalist covering it. And as far as the people of Hong Kong, where were they in that frame, right? The departing British and the flag was part of what was on TV. The Chinese Communist Party was well represented. Where were the people of Hong Kong on that day?
You know, it's interesting, isn't it? They weren't really in the frame at all. If you look at those pictures of the handover ceremony, you'll notice that the Chinese delegation was on one side of the stage, the British delegation was on the other side of the stage. There were a few really important Hong Kongers who were kind of crammed in the middle, but they never even spoke during that handover ceremony. Mm. And, you know, Hong Kongers were really spectators during the most important moment of their lives.
Yeah. Well, as you write in your book, there were warnings about the Hong Kong people and their identity and what would happen to it during the negotiations for this handover. And one person you write about, and you describe him as being prophetic for his warnings about, you know, what happens if Beijing doesn't keep his promises, is S.Y. Chung. What did he warn about?
So he was a really interesting character. He was a Hong Konger who advised the British, and he warned them that there needed to be safeguards in place in case Beijing was to violate its agreement. And he, you know, he also went to China and he tried to warn Deng Xiaoping, the Chinese leader at the time, and he said to him, what would happen if China changes, if Chinese officials don't follow this agreement, or if China moves in a more leftwards direction, what then happens? And he was humiliated on both sides. Both the British and the Chinese tried to shut him up. So, you know, nowadays, those warnings do look really prophetic.
Yeah, and of course, here we are. And I mean, you yourself reported on some of the protests in Hong Kong and the crackdowns. Give us a moment or two of what you saw that illustrate people of Hong Kong trying to preserve their identity and what happened to them?
I mean, the thing that sticks in my mind is just the scale of the protests. There was one protest that 2 million people were estimated to attend. You know, that's 2 million people in a city of 7 million. And I remember walking up onto a pedestrian bridge and just looking down, and you could not see any street space. There were so many people just crammed in every available space. So it was really a whole of society mobilization. In the years since, China's really remade Hong Kong, and it is trying to rewrite not just the history of the protests, but even Hong Kong's own history, now claiming that it never was a British colony. That level of rewriting, I think, is an extraordinary thing to see when an entire population is being gaslit.
Yeah. And now your book captures a sadness, a mourning of the loss of Hong Kong and its story. You know, it's such a story of the occupiers get to write the history. And one person you write about a lot as kind of a face of this is the King of Kowloon. Tell us about him and why his story really drew you as a picture of this.
So the King of Kowloon was this figure who was really famous when I was growing up in Hong Kong. He was this old, eccentric man who would often be seen on the streets drawing on the walls of the city. And he would use calligraphy ink to paint in really terrible Chinese characters all over, not just the walls, but the flyovers, the electricity boxes, the lampposts and post boxes. And he believed that the peninsula of Kowloon had belonged to his family and had been stolen from them when Hong Kong was given to the British. And they were the rightful owners of the land, the kings of Kowloon. And he spent 50 years writing his claims to the land all over the city. And he became this kind of folk hero. And he became an artist. He had these exhibitions. He even represented Hong Kong at the Venice Biennale and became its most valuable artist at a certain point in time. So I was fascinated by his story, and I was particularly fascinated because everybody thought he was mad, but the ideas that he was painting about, writing about, these ideas of sovereignty and territory and dispossession and loss, I mean, they're at the very heart of Hong Kong's political crisis.
And at the very start of your book, you write about this loss of identity, this loss of ownership of the story. And in the prologue, you write that given the political reality of Hong Kong today, you had to remove some of the names of the people you interviewed. I mean, talk about confiscating their stories. What was it like to write that section for you? You grew up there.
Yeah, it was really hard because the whole idea that I had, what I wanted to do was to restore Hong Kongers to their own history because, you know, for a place that has been twice colonized, it's had all these different histories imposed upon it. So I had wanted to use this book to put Hong Kongers at the center of their story and to really center Hong Kong voices. And then because of the national security legislation, this became difficult and even dangerous for interviewees. And so I started to have to take out names, to take out details, to remove people. And that was something that was really painful to do because it really went against what I wanted to do. But of course, the safety of my interviewees is the most important thing. But in the current climate, it's almost impossible to know what is safe and what isn't. So that in itself was really, really difficult.
Well, I think that's a good place to end this conversation. Louisa Lim is journalist and author of the book Indelible City, Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong. And she has a new podcast about the King of Kowloon. Louisa, great pleasure. Thank you as always.
Thank you, Scott.